Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Rayanam Namaskrutam Naram Chayvam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Dato Jaya Mudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadrishu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Translations and purports by Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. 7th Canto, 11th Chapter, verses 33 and 34. Gopyamanam
Bhuhu
Kshetram Nirviryatam Iyat Nakalpate
Puna
Tuchai
Uktam
Bijam
Cha
Nashyati
Devam
Kama Ashayam Chitam Kamana Ati Sevaya Virajeta Yata Rajan Agnivat Kama Binduvi Upyamanam Uhukshetram
Upyamanam
Uhukshetram
Upyamanam Uhukshetram
Svayam Nirviryatam Iyat
Svayam
Nirviryatam Iyat
Svayam Nirviryatam Iyat
Kalpate Punaksuchai Kalpate punaksyutai
Uktam bijam chanashyati
Uktam bijam chanashyati Evam kamashayam chitam. Just do this first. Upyamanam uhukshetram
Upyamanam uhukshetram
Svayam nirviryatam iyat
Svayam nirviryatam iyat
Kalpate punaksuchai
Kalpate punaksuchai
Uktam bijam nanashyati
Uktam bijam nanashyati
Upyamanam uhukshetram
Upyamanam uhukshetram
Svayam nirviryatam iyat
Svayam nirviryatam iyat
Kalpate punaksutai
Kalpate punaksutai
Uttam bijam chanashyati
Uttam bijam chanashyati Ogyamana muhukshetram Vayam nirvetam
niyat
Kalpate punaksutai
Yamanam
Uyamanam
being cultivated.
Muhu
again and again.
Again.
Kshetram
Kshetram
a field. Svayam
itself.
Nirviryatam
Nirviryatam
barrenness.
Iyat
may obtain.
Nakalpate
is not suitable.
Punak
again. Suchai
or
growing further harvest.
Uktam
sown. Bijam the seed.
Cha
and
Nashyati
is spoiled.
Evam
in this way.
Kama Ashayam
full of lusty desires.
Chitam,
the core of the heart.
Kamanam,
of the desirable object.
Ati Sevaya,
by enjoyment over and over again.
Virajeta,
may become detached.
Yata,
just as.
Rajan,
O King.
Agnivat,
a fire. Kamabindubi.
Kamabindubi.
By small drops of clarified butter.
By small drops of clarified butter.
Translation. My dear King, if an agricultural field is cultivated again and again, the power of its production decreases, and whatever seeds are sown there are lost. Just as drops of ghee on a fire never extinguish the fire, but a flood of ghee will, similarly, overindulgence in lusty desires mitigate such desires entirely. My dear King,
if an agricultural field
is cultivated again and again,
the power of its production decreases.
And whatever seeds are sown there are lost.
Just as drops of ghee
on a fire never extinguish the fire,
but a flood of ghee will.
Similarly,
overindulgence and lusty desires
mitigate such desires entirely. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. If one continuously sprinkles drops of ghee on a fire, the fire will not be extinguished. But if one suddenly puts a lump of ghee on a fire, the fire may possibly be extinguished entirely. Similarly, those who are too sinful and have thus been born in the lower classes are allowed to enjoy sinful activities fully, for thus there is a chance that these activities will become detestable to them, and they will get the opportunity to be purified. Om Agena Timirandasya Ganaranjana Salakaya Chaksurin Militam Jena Tasmai Ishi Guru Vain Maha. These lower forms of life might be considered a form of punishment. When criminals are punished, they're put in prison. This is for punishment and also to encourage them to become reformed. Just as sometimes people become criminal, one of their impetuses in becoming criminal is that they're too lazy to work, so they think they can steal and thereby earn their livelihood without having to be active and work all the time. So punishment for such persons is, in a way, it's granting their desire. They have to sit in a cell all day. They don't have to do any work. They have their maintenance supplied. They have their food supplied. And they can indulge in being leisurely. But at the same time, because the nature of the soul is always active, is always seeking variety, because that's our nature, mame vamsa jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana, part and parcel of Krishna. Such a person becomes desirous sometimes to enter the mainstream of society and be active again. So this type of punishment is also a type of reform, in at least a hope to reform. So everything is happening by the interaction of the modes of nature in the material world, and activity is creating karmic reactions. So those born in such lower births, as we've been reading, are punished, but at the same time they're given an opportunity. It's an opportunity to reform, to indulge in sinful activity, to become satiated by such activities, to become exhausted. And this is an impetus to take up a productive spiritual life. Also, Narada describes previously in the first canon of the Bhagavatam that one has to become nivritta sukham, to give up or be free from this desire to enjoy. And this is the beginning of spiritual life. In fact, he says that only such persons deserve to take up spiritual life. When their material desires are completely absent, then they can begin to take up spiritual life. So this is rather exceptional, this situation being described here in this verse, that if one overindulges, just as a big lump of ghee put on a fire can extinguish it, then material life can become exhausted. But as it's explained, drops of ghee on the fire, they simply add fuel to the fire. So the idea is that as we try to enjoy, the appetite to enjoy becomes greater. So it's not that one should take this idea of overindulgence to be a normative thing or an impetus to spiritual life. Because indulgence is, as Prabhupada says, the more we try to exploit the resources of material nature, the more we become entangled in our complexity. He describes it as an itch. If that itch is scratched, the itching increases. So the normal thing is that if we attempt to gratify desire, the desire will increase. So the path of Nivritti Marga is, or the path of renunciation, is to come away from these desires and not to indulge them, because to indulge them means to encourage and increase them. So Chanakya Pandit, Prabhupada quoted once, is saying that those who engage in austerity are those who are infirm or weak or ill. Our desire to perform austerity is very difficult. Our natural desire in the material world is to attempt to exploit and to enjoy. And it's only when, usually, at least from a material point of view, there's some restriction in the form of disease, that we see someone's regularly engaged in refraining the senses from fulfilling themselves entirely. So overindulgence, as it is usually practiced, it can hobble a person's ability so much to enjoy that he is forcibly pushed to austerity. And then that can become a qualification to spiritual life. Prabhupada used to talk about how the hippies had this qualification of being detached from material life, that he was somewhat amused that they were born of well-to-do parents and were living homeless and poor and so on, voluntarily. So that, he said, is their qualification, to have the opportunity to live opulently, but voluntarily they're accepting some very poor, simple form of life. So that can be a qualification. So even as a human being progresses and burns out these desires, as we read in Bhagavad Gita, the desire for sense enjoyment remains. Rasa Raja Masopyasya. That desire remains, and even in old age, people, if they're not able because they're physically debilitated or too old to enjoy, then they're enjoying on the mental plane all forms of sense gratification and sense enjoyment. I remember one time Prabhupada was, I think he was in Paris, but anyway, he was talking about the old men that go to the bars in Paris, and they're beyond the point of having any vigor left in their lives, but they go out and dance with the young girls, or they watch them, and in this way they have this vicarious enjoyment, even though there's no possibility they can enjoy, but they enjoy in that way. So it continues. And because the world today has found ways to enjoy with its modern technology, it's all being utilized to increase the frequency and level of sense gratification, there's been a reaction. And now, especially I think in this country, we're reading about how the greenhouse effect is there. So many billions of tons of particulate matter are sent up into the atmosphere every year, and they're creating the greenhouse effect, and the rivers are polluted, and the air is polluted, the water is polluted, the food is all polluted. So due to this excessive enjoyment, trying to exploit everything to the limit, now there's been a nemesis of the material nature. And again, this can be a qualification for spiritual life. When there's no more obvious paths to enjoyment, then a person can begin to hear about spiritual life. So, as devotees, we're always the greatest opportunists for Krishna, for spiritual life. Prabhupada explained this in terms of a good businessman. If he's very expert, he says that he sits in one place and he buys and sells. And he gets his 7%. Whether the market is going up or the market is going down, he knows when and how to buy and when and how to sell. So he's always profiting, if he's expert. So similarly, the devotees of Krishna, they're very eager to profit for Krishna. So they're taking advantage of every situation. A materially retrograde situation is very good for a devotee. He knows how to take advantage of it. On the other hand, a materially affluent or opulent situation is also good for a devotee. He can take advantage and utilize the situation to propagate Krishna consciousness. So, in this age, as we've been reading, Kalasudra Sambhavan, it is not possible to distinguish who is a Sudra, who is a Brahmin, and so on. So in these instructions, the ideal is gradually being told how human beings should behave. Of course, as Prabhupada writes, that basically Krishna consciousness, it's a movement of Brahmins and Kshatriyas. But because it is impossible to tell who is who, and the nature of Kali Yuga is that everything is reversed or topsy-turvy, we cannot know. So to understand that someone is born a Shudra or born a Vaishya practically has no meaning. When the Kali Yuga began, it was symbolized by the personification of Kali, who, although committing horrendous acts, was in the garments of a ruler. So this was the symbol for the future of the age, that people who have the mentality of very low-class persons would wear the dress, become the form of the judges and men in government, dressed very nicely. But their mentality is actually like this, to send millions of animals to the slaughterhouse, to send human beings unnecessarily to be killed in unnecessary wars, and to gratify the senses without limit. This is the nature of Sudra mentality, to unrestrictedly gratify the senses. And when such persons rise to the post of government leaders, then they're willing to do that at the cost of the lives of all the citizens. Whereas Kshatriya means one who is a protector of all the citizens at all times and accepts responsibility for anything that goes wrong in human society. That's the meaning of Kshatriya. And of course, brahminical life, that is also hypocrisy. People born in so-called brahminical families are using their intelligence, whatever they may have, also to better gratify the senses, to exploit others. And rather than to see that leaders are being faithful to their natural propensity, according to Varnashram Dharma, are prostituting themselves to gain favors from such leaders. So we see that there are so many friendships between the hierarchy and the various churches and so on, and in government. This is all based on mutual exploitation, and religious principles are completely compromised so that there is no actual religious principle. Because without devotional service, as Prabhupada says, all religion is cheating. There can be no religious principle without devotional service. So the idea of establishing Varnashram, as explained in this chapter, is to give everyone a chance. Even those, of course, everyone is born Sudra, but even those who apparently have no opportunity can have the opportunity, according to devotional service, to gradually lift themselves up. So the lower classes are given an opportunity to exhaust themselves materially. In Varnashram society, it's understood that not everyone is able to follow all the principles, so the Shudra class have some license. However, the instruction is there, according to these instructions by Narada Muni, that the Shudras are also meant to maintain cleanliness. and gradually develop austerity. If a shudra does not elevate himself, then he has to keep taking birth again and again, taking birth as a shudra. So this is a very unhospitable future. So the path of Nivritti Marg is actually a path of austerity. And the more one is able to engage in basic austerities, the more one develops love for God. It's proportionate. The more we can free ourselves, extricate ourselves from material entanglement, the more the seed for devotional service can grow in the heart. Therefore, it's described, the metaphor is given as the seed. The seed is something that has to grow with very careful cultivation. And cultivation is to engage in various devotional practices. Then the seed can grow. If devotional practices are not strong, then they will be overcome by weeds, strangled, and not able to grow. So Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is the science of how to grow this seed of devotion through the path of Nivritti. Or Narada's instructions of Pancharatriki give very detailed instructions on how devotional life must progress. So Vaishnava's duty is to explain this in terms of its scientific application, how one from any position can engage in devotional practices and gradually come to the point of a pure Vaishnavism, which is transcendental to all four divisions of Varnashram, Brahma, Vaishya, Sudra. They're all insignificant. So essentially Prabhupada began the movement with a society of Brahmins. Brahmins meaning those who can teach the rest of society. And one of a Brahmin's qualifications is that he can teach others. He can teach a Vaishya how to be a Vaishya, he can teach a Sudra how to engage in Sudra activities in devotional service, and he can teach those who are on the, in all classes, he can teach the Kshatriyas. And there are many instances when this happens, when a Brahmin will teach a Kshatriya or Vaishya how to engage in devotional service. So the Brahmin is the head of society. When the head is in place, then everything else can function. The head instructs the legs, the stomach, the arms how to operate. So Brahmins, being the head of society, teach all classes how to operate properly. So first there must be the head. When the head is there, then everything can function properly. If there's no head, it's simply a dead body without any function, whatever. So Prabhupada gave in detail instructions how Krishna consciousness could be established. There's a passage in the first canto where he describes how if everyone in the world fasts 2 days out of the month, then society will improve. There will be gigantic savings in terms of foodstuffs and energy. If young girls are married shortly after puberty, then society will become pure. There will be a lack of Parnasankara, which is the prevailing mentality in the age of Kali. People should read Srimad Bhagavatam every day, should rise early. They should carry out certain basic devotional practices, particularly Sankirtan Yajna, chanting together the holy names of the Lord. They should congregate and regularly do this. So by these simple processes, Prabhupada was giving a blueprint for all of society by which Varnashram could gradually take place. Not just that it's an idea that devotional service can take place without any practical application, but this is given so that there will be a future opportunity for people of all walks of life to engage in devotional service. This was the vision, actually, of Bhakti Vinod, to see Krishna consciousness spread in this way. So I'll read the verse again and then we can have some questions. Upyamanam uhukshetram svayam nivri yatam miya nakalpate punaksutyai uptam bijam nanashyati chanashyati. My dear king, if an agricultural field is cultivated again and again, the power of its production decreases, and whatever seeds are sown there are lost. Just as drops of ghee on a fire never extinguish the fire, but a flood of ghee will. Similarly, overindulgence and lusty desires mitigate such desires entirely. Any comments or questions? Yes.
It seems like on the basis of these prayers, the groups like Rajneesh, they build the whole philosophy that would be simple. But from your explanation that someone who overindulges in something, the reaction would be that nature forces them, they can't indulge in it, and then they want to become ill or whatever, but
well, that's an example of using the Shastra for ulterior motives, or twisting the meaning when someone takes a verse like this to say they can indulge unlimitedly and therefore become free from desire. It's kind of like saying that, such people we see actually don't overcome desire. By their practical result, we see that they don't overcome desire. Rather, they become more and more desirous. So it's like going to a university but never graduating. Say that I can perform this activity and eventually I'll be free from such desire. But we see they don't become free, even after many, many years. So one can take scriptural injunctions, because actually we have to take the whole thing. We can't take part of it. What was the example? Prabhupada said they wanted to take the just one half of the chicken, the part that laid the eggs. But then the whole chicken doesn't function. So to understand the essence of scripture, we have to understand the whole teaching first. And even as Prabhupada writes in the purport, you can tell he's making a qualification. He says, if one suddenly puts a lump of ghee on the fire, the fire may possibly be extinguished entirely. Similarly, those who are too sinful and have thus been born in lower classes are allowed to enjoy, for thus there is a chance that these activities will become detestable to them. And of course, there are many instances throughout the Vedas of great devotees who were given an opportunity to gratify their senses, and they, after some time, became disgusted with them. But these are not ordinary people. The rule is that the more we try to enjoy, the more we want to enjoy. It's just like this example of ghee on a fire. So to use that as an excuse or a sanction for unrestricted sense gratification is actually a form of cheating. As we see from the result, such persons don't actually get spiritual life.
It's also very risky, because perhaps this is a chance if you put a fire, but if it doesn't put the fire out, then with all that added ghee on it, it gradually heats up and then turns the rest into flames.
Be a big explosion.
The position gets more and more precarious.
Yeah, it becomes can be a big explosion. So it's like I was saying earlier, the whole world is in this is present condition of there's so much concern, and it's a real concern. In Los Angeles, you can barely breathe the air. There's so much, and this is just due to people having to drive so much, thinking they have to drive cars so much because they have to enjoy their senses so much. So when it's reached such extreme proportions that it reaches now, then the reaction is so much greater that even ordinary people, they're now beginning to realize, well, I can't even breathe good air anymore, and they're extremely distressed what to do. And there's a little sense that because that there's been no moderation in the last 100 years or so with so much advancement in technology, that we've sort of gotten ourselves into this situation, and now we're getting a reaction to it. So it's very, very dangerous to even to sit and watch television. It seems such a passive, innocuous activity for most people, but I don't know if they have this word here, couch potato. It's a very popular word in America. It's what they call people who watch television all day. Well, couch potato. They just have this control, and they watch people enjoy their senses all day. All night they watch. And they become couch potatoes. They become like a vegetable. Because they're enjoying on one level or another. If they're not actively enjoying, they're just passively enjoying. Their minds are completely enwrapped in some form of sense gratification. They become immobile. So the whole function of the brain, which is meant to indulge in spiritual topics, it becomes completely atrophied. There's no activity anymore. So Krishna consciousness is a very active thing. It becomes almost impossible to even think what to speak of, engage in some form of renunciation. So even the mind becomes of course the mind is the initiator of sense activity, but it becomes completely flaccid, unable to function properly. So what chance is there for spiritual life? Everybody becomes so muted in their sense gratification, and the process becomes so dull.
It doesn't seem in general that the people who are deep involved in intoxication, you read the Srimad Bhagavatam before, they knew this. And they lower classes and they just doing it.
Yeah, so Prabhupada says we should establish the divine Varnashram principle in which the whole society is directed, even the Shudra population, because they're serving at least those who are spiritually advanced, they can make advancement. Otherwise, there's no value to this. It's simply karmakandiya activity in all four classes. It has no meaning. So the idea is that if a sutra does not raise himself, then he's relegated to a particular hellish platform, hellish planet. So the principle is established on divine principles, Varnashram. Otherwise it's simply material. Entangling. Krishna
fasting and early marriage and exercise to reduce society. Well, my question is, you see that on the one hand people find it very difficult to practice consciousness with all of the material sentiments and things and distractions from the consciousness. So when we're preaching to people, what level do we want to actually take up the culture of Vaishnavism? How much should we do especially with perception like that?
Well, Lord Chaitanya's first principle is everyone must chant Hare Krishna and chant dance in ecstasy. And the principle was to go everywhere and chant Hare Krishna. That was Lord Chaitanya's pastime. And to distribute prasadam very profusely. And in this way, the system was established. And of course, our disciples' succession is carrying that same system forward. That it is a movement of chanting, dancing, and glorifying Krishna. So that's the first principle. When one develops a little shraddha or faith through the chanting of the holy name in association with devotees, then they can begin to hear. So it's a step-by-step, very scientific process, which Lord Chaitanya began. It has to begin with one thing, then progress to another, and then another. As soon as that faith is there, shraddha then, there's sadhusanga, gradually there's some association with devotees. And as that becomes more mature, then people can hear the more detailed aspects of Krishna consciousness philosophy. But first they have to have respect for the people who are propounding this idea, then they'll accept the idea. Everything has to go step by step.
Is that all that we want?
Is that all that we want?
accepting the practice or the detail?
Well, society is divided eventually, then not everyone will practice all the details. Not everyone will always all be doing the same thing. There will be some division, social division. But as I was saying, Prabhupada first wanted to establish a brahminical society so that all the knowledge would be there. Once all the knowledge of all aspects of Krishna consciousness is there, then activity can be divided, just like we divide activity ourselves. We have someone's a pujari, someone is doing something completely different, selling books. That's practical. But all the knowledge has to be there so that society can be trained. Therefore, Prabhupada said that his books are like like law books, the constitution for the future of society. So since we're just the beginning of Krishna consciousness spreading around the world, we have to learn all aspects of Krishna consciousness. Then we'll know how things can be divided up. Yeah.
On one hand, we're discussing how unlimited sense gratification is, hardly ever conducive to spiritual realization. And on the other hand, it appears at times that individuals who try too ardently to become very pure very quickly are also not successful, and then again they regard that as sense gratification. So is there some kind of to what extent can we actually be realistic about how much we can actually measure and be with it?
You mean to say that if one tries to overindulge in Krishna consciousness, you might fall down?
You know, there are cases of members of our society who, you know, it seems to be very respectful, very
Well, there's a verse that says if one engages in devotional service, however he may try to do it, he may fall down, but still he hasn't lost anything, because as we understand from Bhagavad Gita, he'll take up the practice again. And because there's a chance that he won't fall down, it's a great opportunity. On the other hand, if someone just tries to gratify the senses, then he has no hope of anything. So better once you try for Krishna consciousness in some way. Well, what's the in-between? You're either Krishna conscious or you're not. You're either on the path of nivritti, trying to advance and renounce material association, or you're on the path of sense enjoyment.
So they're all the war wounded, they still get medals. The war wounded still get medals.
Well, it depends what war they're fighting. If they're fighting the war to become a devotee, of course they always get it. If they're fighting the war to exploit the senses, or the war against Krishna consciousness, then that verse says that they won't get rewarded. So again, this one can use such a verse to as an excuse to just enjoy, but spiritual life is not that at all. It's not meant for that. I have so many bogus principles are introduced on the strength of scripture and so on. Even Indra introduced so many bogus principles as he was on the path of enjoyment, path of false sannyas and so on. So it's a very like a razor's edge, a very difficult path in that sense, that we have to be very careful not to be victimized by sense gratification. But we can't overindulge in Krishna consciousness, because it's measured by our eagerness. Krishna consciousness is measured by how much eager we are to engage in the process. And it's not that if we become more eager, we'll become bewildered. So the idea is to be very eager for Krishna consciousness, try to embrace it completely. And Krishna says that he rewards us according to our desire, according to our degree of surrender. So basically, if we follow Krishna's instructions, Guru Shastra and Sadhu and so many other instructions, very carefully, being overly enthusiastic will be very good for us. I mean, we can't overindulge in Krishna consciousness. You understand? If we follow the principle. There's always a chance of falling down everywhere at every time because material nature is so dangerous. But if we compromise Krishna consciousness, in other words, if we say we shouldn't fully engage in Krishna consciousness because somebody did that and they fell down, then we're not being honest with ourselves. So we can't use that as an excuse. It's like saying we've got a counterfeit I got a counterfeit dollar bill, so therefore all the money is counterfeit. How no? Counterfeit. So then there's no respect for the ordinary thing. So that's also sometimes frequently said, that there's a counterfeit, therefore. Why should I attempt the process? There's a chance of falling down, therefore I shouldn't even try. Or I should only try on a compromised basis. But actually, Prabhupada said he wanted all of his disciples to become pure devotees. He said that many times. It's not that I want some of you to become half devotees, some of you to follow two of the principles, and some of you to follow three of the principles. Also, remember one lecture where Prabhupada was saying that initiation means beginning. The word in English, it means beginning of something. So it's not that at the time we take initiation, we take some vows, that it stops there. It's a static principle, but it's actually a very dynamic principle, initiation. It means that we're growing in our spiritual life all the time. And the devotee's thinking how to become a pure devotee, not how to hedge Krishna consciousness or become a half devotee or a compromised devotee. So this is a natural disease that creeps into Krishna consciousness, that we can compromise, or we should make compromises in the course of becoming a bigger society, more complex society, dividing ourselves into fascias sometimes and this and that. Sometimes we'll try to make some compromise. But actually the idea is we have to become a pure devotee. I was reading one purport where Prabhupada says although one should engage very happily in family life and Krishna consciousness, he must be prepared to leave it at any moment. So this is the path of Nivritti Marg. You have to embrace it with great enthusiasm. And this is an investment like no other investment. You can invest in the material world. It's prudent not to invest everything sometimes. Otherwise one might be fanatical. Just put all your money in one venture. But in Krishna consciousness, as we read in Bhagavatam, whatever you give to Krishna consciousness, it comes back by unlimited multiplication. Even in the Karmakandiya philosophy, it doesn't come back completely. It might come back two times or four times, giving to a Brahmin. But anything given to Krishna consciousness, it comes back unlimitedly. So there's no more providential investment than investing in Krishna consciousness. You can invest every single breath of your being, your very life. That was what Bali Maharaj did. He gave. He's famous for giving everything to Krishna. He became glorious. So it's not that we should limit how much we can throw ourselves into Krishna consciousness because it's overindulging in any way.
I understand Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Swati Thakur says that Grihastha Ashram is sort of a concession to sense gratification. If he said that, what is the purport behind that?
Behind it? What do you mean behind it?
Did he say that it's sort of a concession for sense gratification?
Well, how much of the purport do you need?
I was thinking that none, that if even the Grihastha Ashram is not meant, it's not actually meant for sense gratification. Grihastha Brahmachari is meant to beget Krishna consciousness.
In other words, it's a restriction, it's a limitation. If one can indulge in sex life only for procreation, that's, Prabhupada said, once practically like being a brahmachari, and under so many conditions, so many mantras have to be chanted and so on. So there's a concession, but it means restriction.
shouldn't be for enjoyment. It should be, concession means that there's limitation within certain very strict rules and bounds. And also means, you could say behind it, the purport is that it's better for one to maintain strict celibacy. At least from Bhaktisiddhanta's point of view, he was Nistika Brahmachari. Of course, Prabhupada's movement is now in the West, so he encouraged everybody in all walks of life to take up Krishna consciousness without restriction, without any, that there shouldn't be any restriction in preaching, whether you're householder or not householder. So even if one is making a concession like this, it shouldn't restrict one's desire and ability to preach.
I appreciate your answer about that there's no restriction on our eagerness, that we should be eager to be nothing short of pure devotees. But in that eagerness, can't creep in some motive that's perhaps got some subtle sanctification motives in there that lead us to think that we're going for the highest goal, but actually maybe we're not. I mean, I understood from the question, you know, that perhaps maybe we overestimate where we're at. And on the basis of that, we perhaps take on too much or, you know, go neglect one aspect of our life because we, you know, thinking that we actually don't need to deal with this or we're in a transcendental platform.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of that, it extinguishes our fire of love for Krishna.
Yeah. So therefore it said spiritual life is like a razor's edge. There's a section. They're everywhere, and we have to be appropriately fearful and respectful of Maya, such that at any point we realize that we can succumb to Maya. They're everywhere, and we have to be appropriately fearful and respectful of Maya, such that at any point we realize that we can succumb to Maya. The potential for falling down is there everywhere, and we have to be appropriately fearful and respectful of Maya, such that at any point we realize that we can fall down, we can succumb to Maya's allurements. Therefore, we have to very carefully follow Lord Chaitanya's instruction about always being a more humble and a strong street, more tolerant than a tree, and being careful not to succumb to pride, false prestige. Very, very difficult. This is what makes spiritual life such a razor's edge, because if one advances in spiritual life, the tendency will be to think, I've advanced in spiritual life, and as soon as one thinks like that, then that is a kind of subtle fall down. So if that's what we mean by overindulgence, that's not good either. So it's not that we're immune by advancing, that we become immune from the material energy. We have to be very careful. At the same time, we have to embrace Krishna consciousness with all of our being.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the story of King Yayati, he was prematurely stuck, stuck with old age. And then he had a chance to get free of that old age by going to his son. So he had two sons, Yadu and Puru, the other two. So Yadu, he said, well, I wouldn't mind taking the old age, but I'm a young man, like, you know, I'm in the midst of my dreams tonight, etc. And I fear that if I did do that, I'd lose my Krishna consciousness in the long run. I'd rather just, you know, wait till I naturally become old, and I'm hoping I'll be detached and I'll be able to become Krishna consciousness. And you have to respect that opinion. And actually, Yadav is a great soul. Krishna appeared in the dynasty. Then, of course, Puru, he was more advanced. And so he immediately accepted the old age, even though he was young. So both of them are kind of recognized. Because their intention is to serve Krishna, but they just perhaps they recognize their position.
Yeah, and it also depends on individuals. Someone can begin spiritual life at a very early age and become a lifelong celibate, and that's very natural, according to karma or whatever. Another person may never take sannyas and still serve Krishna from that platform, and engage in sense gratification, but with the bona fide concession, and still be as effective or even more a preacher as someone who's lifelong celibate. So it's not that we make a distinction that when it comes to preaching, one is on a higher level than another. It can be, either can be. And as you say, both are recognized in the story of King Yati. Sometimes, I forgot who it was, but someone asked, I was lecturing. I thought it was a very interesting answer. When does one know when to take sannyas? And the answer was, it's just like cutting a fingernail. You have to do it at the right time, otherwise it's very painful. So everything has to be done in a very practical way. Better not to take this path. If the mentality is such that one really has to become a family man, that's what's really there. One, we have to know ourselves. We have to be very practical too. It's not that we can engage in the various types of Krishna conscious practices without being practical in terms of our own nature or in terms of the situation. But this is what Prabhupada's great potency was, how to do everything in a very practical way. We have to understand who we are. I was reading one letter the other day. Someone wrote Prabhupada named Jennifer. I don't know what the letter was, because we just had a Prabhupada's response, but Prabhupada said, first decide whether you are a man or a woman, then take up Krishna consciousness. It's also a very confused individual, but we do. I mean, Krishna consciousness, self-realization implies that we know who we are, who I am. We have to very carefully assess our own situation in terms of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu before we decide what we're going to do with our lives. So it's very important that we consult with other devotees. It's a verse, it's not a verse, but it's a purport to a verse in the Chaitanya Chaitanya right in the beginning. Where Prabhupada says that if we don't consult with others, then we can't go back to Godhead. One who refuses to consult with others, including a spiritual master, in the Adi Lila, becomes an offender at the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead. So we have to be very careful. It can seem very inspiring to do a particular thing in Krishna consciousness, but it may be completely impractical. So unless we associate properly with more advanced devotees, or even any devotees, to try to get some perspective on what we're doing, then we can make a very seriously wrong decision. Centripetal or centripetal?
It is the opposite of centripetal.
Yeah.
And it brings the consciousness and the senses within into internal consciousness instead of one searching for sense objects for pleasure. And so that was an interesting. A lot of discussion is something that is changed.
Because Krishna is the super soul, we can enjoy within spiritual senses of Krishna. Still senses, but directed in the proper way. Any other points?
You mentioned that the devotees can always take advantage of materially bad situations. And you also mentioned the rate of pollution and the way that everything becomes so degrading. So I'm wondering, how much should devotees, there's a lot of statistics put out by ecology groups and fashion figures, how much should devotees make use of these in the future?
No, it depends on what type of preaching you're doing. The principle is we should take what we need for Krishna consciousness and reject what we don't need for Krishna consciousness. As much as we can use something in a practical way for Krishna consciousness, we should use it. On the other hand, if we're just memorizing statistics and we don't use them, then it's not practical. There's an infinite array of statistics out there. We could learn about such things. But if we can't actually use it all in Krishna consciousness, then it's not necessary. So the idea of this knowing how to adopt what's favorable and unfavorable is based on this principle of accepting and rejecting, accepting the favorable and rejecting the unfavorable. So gradually we have to learn how to become expert in this. It's not that any devotee can always, we have to learn how to do it. It's an art, I call it the art of bhakti yoga. We have to learn how to use everything in Krishna's service, but we can't do that all at once. We see all different things in Krishna's service. Of course, as an impure devotee, he sees nothing separate from Krishna. So whatever he does, he's using, whatever he uses, it's all being done in service of Krishna. He's perfect in making the distinction. So some things are obvious we can use. But on the other hand, if we accept too many things that are indirectly Krishna conscious or not part of Krishna conscious, then one can be, you know, we can get exploited by the material energy. So we have to be a little careful. I mean, we want to be devotees first and ecologists second. Anything else? Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Prabhupada ki jai.